It's good to see you all for two reasons. First, it's good that you're here. And secondly, I can actually see you. Usually when there's twice as many people here, it's kind of hard to make out individuals. It's just kind of like a mass of people. But here, I can see everybody, which is great.
Where is everybody?
One guest, really.
Don't forget to sign in.
The virus, right?
Don't forget to sign in.
Oh, it's the virus?
Yes, Julie, you got it.
Ruby said, look how small my eyes are.
Say again?
But they see you enormous.
Alright, so, let's see. I guess the most, the first announcement. We have a good class today, I think. The first announcement is that I don't know what's going to happen in the future. No one does. It's possible, I think even likely, that we won't have the next two classes. The one on March 20th and the one on April 3rd. I don't know that for sure. I'm just kind of projecting that because of the because they're close to campus. If that's the case, you will hear about it because I will email you. You're on the email list, right? If you're not, put your name.
What? Sorry, I didn't bring the list.
Oh, that's okay. If anybody is not on the email list, write your name on one of the registration forms and then give it to Robert. Okay, so that you can be added to the email list. Otherwise, because most of you are not checking your pipeline email. You don't even know you have one. So our email list will suffice.
I don't have pipeline. I don't know how I should check.
Don't.
Morty. I emailed you to find out if there was a class today, but I didn't get a response.
When did you email me?
Yesterday.
But we
had
an
email for your
special. Emailed everybody
who laughed. Did you get his email?
I emailed the whole class.
He emailed the whole class.
I didn't get one.
Well, Morty, you ought to give him your email address again. Because
I don't have my email address, Dr. Spencer.
What's his
name? I don't have my email address.
Call the shop center to find out.
Well, I called yesterday and their phone wasn't working.
Their phone was... will work.
But the end of yesterday.
Okay, it will. Okay. All right, so let's kind of focus. All right, so again, I don't know. If classes are canceled, you'll receive an official note. Well, you'll hear about it.
You'll also
receive an official notification on your pipeline email, which you won't see. And you'll also receive an email from me.
It'll be on the news.
And if you have any question, you email me at pipeline, at my Santa Barbara City College email, and I will email you back and tell you. So I'm not sure. I just talked with the administrators, they don't care. Anything I should know, I'm going to bring the screen down. Can I do that? Supposedly the screen is down. It says on. The display was down. I don't think so.
Maybe you have to open the curtain.
No. Of course, the guys are on. Yeah, we're supposed to have a screen coming down. All right, good. I'm glad you're here, Israel.
What's that?
I guess I'm going to blast it from behind. This says red.
Red? I'll get some batteries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
which would make that thing go off.
But I am not touching that thing.
What?
Because nothing works the way it's supposed to. All right, so. I emailed you. There's a Robert made a video of the interview last week, and it is posted on swt.org/Spencer on our site. Okay, please remember to sign in. So on this. On this site, you can find, you can find the video from last week if you'd like to see it again. And eventually, when the smoke clears, I will. and it's also on YouTube. So it's posted up on YouTube also, so you can see it there. Thank you to Michael, who, he recorded the audio, but Robert did the video version. Caroline.
Do you have the title of the YouTube one?
Well, just in the Google, in the YouTube search bar, just search for Spencer Sherman.
Okay. So
yeah.
Come in there. Okay. Yeah, just search me or search Jonathan Schuller, and it comes right up. Okay. My Supermind on April 20th was canceled. Unfortunately, if you signed up for it already, you'll get a refund, and I will email you and tell you how to see his unbelievable video that some of us saw in this class on YouTube, and also the link to his new book, which describes that research.
So the art show, the art thing is canceled too because of the thing?
Say again?
We don't know. We don't know yet. She's talking about the last class here.
Oh, we don't know yet. We really don't know yet.
If you get the last class, we'll do it, but not, we won't do it, right?
We don't know.
Yeah.
Let's see. Okay. Let's talk a little bit about mindfulness as it is useful in keeping you calm or making you more calm when you need to get to be more calm. I hope for most of you this is review, but let's do the review. These are two traditional, yeah.
Before you get started, I just want to thank you
for
Diana
Pearson.
Yes.
Ah, okay.
Good job.
Got it, okay.
Thank you.
I should recognize you, I know you. That's what it was, okay. I remember people visually very much better than I remember them in any other way, auditorily. These are two traditional ways of looking at mindfulness that I think are particularly relevant for keeping us in a calm state of mind. One is the one on the right here. You can imagine a bucket in your torso. And the bucket, and when you first get up in the morning from a really peaceful sleep, you know how calm you feel and how clear when you first open your eyes, everything sparkles, or it shines, everything seems very clear. It's as though there's white sand at the bottom of the bucket and there's very still water above it. And then you think, oh my God, it's 9:00 and I'm supposed to be up at 7:00. And immediately your thoughts start swirling the sand up into the water, and you walk around in a state of semi-murky agitation pretty much throughout our lives. Especially these days, these extraordinary days, it's very easy to get into an agitated state. And when you get too agitated, it's unproductive and harmful. So how do you get back to the state of sand at the bottom and calm, clear water above it? What can you do to the bucket to get that back to that pristine state? What could you do? What's the only strategy that will work for getting back to calmness and clarity? Just let it settle. You got to just let it sit down. You just got to let it stop swirling. The problem is, if I just tell people, go sit, something happens that keeps the swirling or even increases the swirling, and that is when people generally sit, they generally get lost in thought, and that increases the swirling. Right? That creates more agitation. So you have to be doing something other than getting lost in thought in order to allow that settling process to happen. And if you pay attention to your breathing, as we've learned to do, and even though you are thinking, not get involved in your thoughts, but just keep coming back to the breathing, then things settle down by themselves because the breathing is rhythmic, natural, and far from the head. And so the only strategy that will work for calming you down is a strategy of allowing that settling process to happen by not continually agitating yourself. That's not what most of us do. The way that most people try to get more calm is by trying to get more calm. The analogy would be, it's trying to push the sand down, I gotta push the sand down to the bottom because I gotta get the sand out of the water so that I can be more calm and clear. What happens when you push the sand down to the bottom, or try to? Creates more agitation, which is why trying to get calm is counterproductive. So when you find yourself doing that, remember that you have a life-saving alternative, which is to simply let go of trying to change anything and feel yourself breathe and let yourself soften and open and feel yourself breathe and let yourself soften and open and just allow things to be as they are and they will calm and clear. Another way to look at this. Sometimes the surface of the ocean is placid, and sometimes the surface of the ocean is roiled. And sometimes you get caught in the waves. If you could sink down to the depth of the ocean, it wouldn't matter what was happening on the surface. You couldn't then do anything about what's happening on the surface, but down in the depth of the ocean, it's always the same. It's always steady. It's always calm. That's not exactly true because there are deep ocean currents, but for the purposes of our metaphor here, it is. So how do you sink down into the depth of yourself rather than be caught at the surface? Not doing. You do wu wei wu. Doing, not doing. That is, instead of trying to change the weather, you just keep returning attention to your breathing. And every time you return attention to your breathing, you take a step back from what's happened. And every time you get caught up in what's happening, you take a step forward into the weather. So right now we can't do anything about a lot of the weather both around us and inside us. But what we can do is find our breath, let ourselves soften and open. And every time you do that, you become the witness rather than what is witnessed. You become the calm, clear awareness rather than whatever is in awareness. And it's very dramatic. When you do this, it really does feel like you're stepping back, and you can, instead of your thoughts being all around you in your head, your thoughts are up here and in front of you slightly. It feels like you're interior to your thoughts. You can hear your thoughts up there, and out there a little bit. And your feelings, the same thing. Instead of being inside you, your feelings are here, in front of you. And your sensations are either peripheral or they're moving through you, but you're in back of them so you can watch them move through the spaciousness that you are. So it really does, it really is a feeling. Michael Singer in The Untethered Soul said, fall behind your experience. I don't like the word fall, I think step behind is better. But you're behind your experience. And whatever it is, but you're not that. You're this. You're the calm, clear awareness in which these things are dancing. So I don't know how many of you have been, how many of you have been using this recently to keep yourself okay in this extraordinary time? Raise your hand so I can see. Okay. Good. Those of you who haven't, you have enough practice to do this. It's not very difficult. It's been so extraordinarily helpful for me because I have a tendency to get a little caught up in things. And so you don't have to sit formally for many minutes. You can just every once in a while, whenever you're not feeling okay, you can just, standing in line at the grocery store where the lines are, you're going to stand in line for a long time, you can just feel your breathing and let yourself soften and open and keep coming back to your breathing, and it will calm you down and clear you up. Okay? So having said all that, let's practice, because otherwise we're just caught up in some thought. Okay? So we'll sit for 10 minutes. You're not trying to change anything, because that would be being involved in what's happening. You're just breathing, softening and opening, allowing yourself to become more spacious, coming back to your breathing again and again, and noticing whatever it is that you notice. And when you get caught up and you remember, come back to your breathing, let yourself soften and open. That's all we're doing.
heater on? I need a heater, it's cold.
I don't think the heater is on. I'm not going to put it on, Julie, because it makes too much noise. For a lot of people, you sure don't make much noise. All right. Since we're going to see a video in a couple of moments, I won't turn the lights on. I'll just talk before and introduce it. When people talk about the most important things for our health, there are generally three areas that they emphasize: nutrition, exercise, and rest. And exercise has been talked about for quite a while now. Some of you remember when the term aerobic exercise first arose and all the subsequent understanding that it's not natural to live the way that we currently live, which is not moving, and that it's necessary to do this weird thing called exercise in order to do what the body is has evolved to be accustomed to doing and function best while doing. So exercise has been well explored, and most of us understand that we have to get our exercise every day. And nutrition, which didn't used to be such a big deal, has become a bigger and bigger deal, as everyone knows, for multiple reasons. But most of us are well aware of the fact that you can't just go into the supermarket and buy anything, that a lot of the stuff that's in the supermarket is really not very good for you. And we have our own individual take and we have our own individual body, but we're kind of on top of the fact that we have to eat well. The emerging star in that triad is rest. It hasn't gotten much play until fairly recently, but its ascension has been extremely rapid. That is, we're realizing that adequate rest, and especially sleep, are absolutely crucial, and certainly equivalent to the other two in terms of our health. Unfortunately, an estimated 2/3 of American adults have significant sleep problems. 2 out of every 3 American adults have significant sleep problems. And so many of us in this room can identify with that. I hope that the two videos I'm going to show you today, both of which are really excellent, encourage you to move in a healthy direction, but I don't want you to be more disturbed than you are by the fact that you don't sleep as well as you know you should. Okay, so the first of these videos, I'm going to read to you the biography of the guy giving the video, because you wouldn't think. He seems like a kind of goofy guy, kind of nice goofy guy. And he certainly presents well, but let me read this biography for you. But first, I guess I got to get this set up, and maybe I'll put the biography up so you can see it also. TED Talk. Want to see it again? And let's get his bio up.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much. Let's see what we got here. Let's see who he is. Okay. probably can't see this, so I'll read it to you. Matt Walker's research examines the impact of sleep on human health and disease. He got his PhD from the Medical Research Council in London, United Kingdom, and subsequently became a professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. He's currently a professor of neuroscience and psychology at the University of California, Berkeley, and director of the Center for Human Sleep Science. Walker has received funding awards from the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health, and he's a Kavli Fellow of the National Academy of Sciences. He shared his research on the importance of sleep on television and radio outlets, including CBS's 60 Minutes, National Geographic, Nova Science, NRP, and the BBC. He is the author of the international bestseller, Why We Sleep. So he's a very credible source. So let's see. Now, I'm not going to close the curtains. I think that we're okay at this point. You can see well enough. I'll leave the closed captions on so you can see them also. So let's get the full screen.
Well, I would like to start with testicles. Men who sleep 5 hours a night have significantly smaller testicles than those who sleep 7 hours or more. In addition, men who routinely sleep just 4 to 5 hours a night will have a level of testosterone which is that of someone 10 years their senior. So a lack of sleep will age a man by a decade in terms of that critical aspect of wellness. And we see equivalent impairments in female reproductive health caused by a lack of sleep. This is the best news that I have for you today. From this point, it may only get worse. Not only will I tell you about the wonderfully good things that happen when you get sleep, but the alarmingly bad things that happen when you don't get enough, both for your brain and for your body. Let me start with the brain and the functions of learning and memory. Because what we've discovered over the past 10 or so years is that you need sleep after learning to essentially hit the save button on those new memories so that you don't forget. But recently we discovered that you also need sleep before learning. And now to actually prepare your brain, almost like a dry sponge, ready to initially soak up new information. And without sleep, the memory circuits of the brain essentially become waterlogged, as it were, and you can't absorb new memories. So let me show you the data. Here in this study, we decided to test the hypothesis that pulling the all-nighter was a good idea. So we took a group of individuals and we assigned them to one of two experimental groups, a sleep group and a sleep deprivation group. Now the sleep group, they're going to get a full 8 hours of slumber, but the deprivation group, we're going to keep them awake in the laboratory under full supervision. There's no naps or caffeine, by the way, so it's miserable for everyone involved. And then the next day, we're going to place those participants inside an MRI scanner. And we're going to have them try and learn a whole list of new facts as we're taking snapshots of brain activity. And then we're going to test them to see how effective that learning has been. And that's what you're looking at here on the vertical axis. And when you put those two groups head to head, what you find is a quite significant 40% deficit in the ability of the brain to make new memories without sleep. I think this should be concerning considering what we know is happening to sleep in our education populations right now. In fact, to put that in context, it would be the difference in a child acing an exam versus failing it miserably. 40%. And we've gone on to discover what goes wrong within your brain to produce these types of learning disabilities. And there's a structure that sits on the left and the right side of your brain called the hippocampus. And you can think of the hippocampus almost like the informational inbox of your brain. It's very good at receiving new memory files and then holding on to them. And when you look at this structure in those people who had a full night of sleep, we saw lots of healthy learning-related activity. Yet in those people who were sleep-deprived, we actually couldn't find any significant signal whatsoever. So it's almost as though sleep deprivation had shut down your memory inbox, and any new incoming files, they were just being bounced. You couldn't effectively commit new experiences to memory. So that's the bad that can happen if I were to take sleep away from you. But let me just come back to that control group for a second. Do you remember those folks that got a full 8 hours of sleep? Well, we can ask a very different question. What is it about the physiological quality of your sleep when you do get it that restores and enhances your memory and learning ability each and every day? And by placing electrodes all over the head, what we've discovered is that there are big, powerful brain waves that happen during the very deepest stages of sleep that have riding on top of them these spectacular bursts of electrical activity that we call sleep spindles. And it's the combined quality of these deep sleep brain waves that acts like a file transfer mechanism at night, shifting memories from a short-term vulnerable reservoir to a more permanent long-term storage site in the brain, and therefore protecting them, making them safe. And it is important that we understand what during sleep actually transacts these memory benefits, because there are real medical and societal implications. And let me just tell you about one area that we've moved this work out into clinically, which is the context of aging and dementia. Because it's, of course, no secret that as we get older, our learning and memory abilities begin to fade and decline. But what we've also discovered is that a physiological signature of aging is that your sleep gets worse. Especially that deep quality of sleep that I was just discussing. And only last year we finally published evidence that these two things, they're not simply co-occurring, they are significantly interrelated. And it suggests that the disruption of deep sleep is an underappreciated factor that is contributing to cognitive decline or memory decline in aging, and most recently we've discovered in Alzheimer's disease as well. Now, I know this is remarkably depressing news. It's in the mail, it's coming at you. But there's a potential silver lining here. Unlike many of the other factors that we know are associated with aging, for example, changes in the physical structure of the brain, that's fiendishly difficult to treat. But that sleep is a missing piece in the explanatory puzzle of aging and Alzheimer's is exciting because we may be able to do something about it. And one way that we are approaching this at my sleep center is not by using sleeping pills, by the way. Unfortunately, they are blunt instruments that do not produce naturalistic sleep. Instead, we're actually developing a method based on this. It's called direct current brain stimulation. You insert a small amount of voltage into the brain, so small you typically don't feel it, but it has a measurable impact. Now, if you apply this stimulation during sleep in young, healthy adults, as if you're sort of singing in time with those deep sleep brain waves, not only can you amplify the size of those deep sleep brain waves, but in doing so, we can almost double the amount of memory benefit that you get from sleep. The question now is whether we can translate this same affordable, potentially portable piece of technology into older adults and those with dementia. can we restore back some healthy quality of deep sleep? And in doing so, can we salvage aspects of their learning and memory function? That is my real hope now. That's one of our moonshot goals, as it were. So that's an example of sleep for your brain, but sleep is just as essential for your body. We've already spoken about sleep loss and your reproductive system. Or I could tell you about sleep loss and your cardiovascular system, and that all it takes is 1 hour. Because there is a global experiment performed on 1.6 billion people across 70 countries twice a year. And it's called daylight savings time. Now, in the spring, when we lose 1 hour of sleep, we see a subsequent 24% increase in heart attacks that following day. In the autumn, when we gain an hour of sleep, we see a 21% reduction in heart attacks. Isn't that incredible? And you see exactly the same profile for car crashes, road traffic accidents, even suicide rates. But as a deeper dive, I want to focus on this, sleep loss and your immune system. And here I'll introduce these delightful blue elements in the image. They are called natural killer cells. And you can think of natural killer cells almost like the Secret Service agents of your immune system. And they are very good at identifying dangerous, unwanted elements and eliminating them. In fact, what they're doing here is destroying a cancerous tumor mass. So what you wish for is a virile set of these immune assassins at all times. And tragically, that's what you don't have if you're not sleeping enough. So here in this experiment, you're not going to have your sleep deprived for an entire night. You're simply going to have your sleep restricted to 4 hours for one single night. And then we're going to look to see what's the percent reduction in immune cell activity that you suffer. And it's not small, it's not 10%, it's not 20%. There was a 70% drop in natural killer cell activity. That's a concerning state of immune deficiency. And you can perhaps understand why we're now finding significant links between short sleep duration and your risk for the development of numerous forms of cancer. Currently, that list includes cancer of the bowel, cancer of the prostate, and cancer of the breast. In fact, the link between a lack of sleep and cancer is now so strong that the World Health Organization has classified any form of nighttime shift work as a probable carcinogen because of a disruption of your sleep-wake rhythms. So you may have heard of that old maxim that you can sleep when you're dead. Well, I'm being quite serious now. It is mortally unwise advice. We know this from epidemiological studies across millions of individuals. There's a simple truth. The shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. Short sleep predicts all-cause mortality. And if increasing your risk for the development of cancer or even Alzheimer's disease were not sufficiently disquieting, we have since discovered that a lack of sleep will even erode the very fabric of biological life itself, your DNA genetic code. So here in this study, they took a group of healthy adults and they limited them to 6 hours of sleep a night for 1 week. And then they measured the change in their gene activity profile relative to when those same individuals were getting a full 8 hours of sleep a night. And there were two critical findings. First, a sizable and significant 711 genes were distorted in their activity caused by a lack of sleep. The second result was that about half of those genes were actually increased in their activity. The other half were decreased. Now, those genes that were switched off by a lack of sleep were genes associated with your immune system. So once again, you can see that immune deficiency. In contrast, those genes that were actually upregulated or increased by way of a lack of sleep were genes associated with the promotion of tumors, genes associated with long-term chronic inflammation within the body, and genes associated with stress and, as a consequence, cardiovascular disease. There is simply no aspect of your wellness that can retreat at the sign of sleep deprivation and get away unscathed. It's rather like a broken water pipe in your home. Sleep loss will leak down into every nook and cranny of your physiology. Even tampering with the very DNA nucleic alphabet that spells out your daily health narrative. And at this point, you may be thinking, oh my goodness, how do I start to get better sleep? What are your tips for good sleep? Well, beyond avoiding the damaging and harmful impact of alcohol and caffeine on sleep, and if you're struggling with sleep at night, avoiding naps during the day, I have two pieces of advice for you. The first is regularity. Go to bed at the same time, wake up at the same time. No matter whether it's the weekday or the weekend, regularity is king, and it will anchor your sleep and improve the quantity and the quality of that sleep. The second is keep it cool. Your body needs to drop its core temperature by about 2 to 3 degrees Fahrenheit to initiate sleep and then to stay asleep. And it's the reason you will always find it easier to fall asleep in a room that's too cold than too hot. So aim for a bedroom temperature of around 65 degrees or about 18 degrees Celsius. That's going to be optimal for the sleep of most people. And then finally, in taking a step back then, what is the mission critical statement here? Well, I think it may be this. Sleep, unfortunately, is not an optional lifestyle luxury. Sleep is a non-negotiable biological necessity. It is your life support system, and it is Mother Nature's best effort yet at immortality. And the decimation of sleep throughout industrialized nations is having a catastrophic impact on our health, our wellness, even the safety and the education of our children. It's a silent sleep loss epidemic, and it is fast becoming one of the greatest public health challenges that we face in the 21st century. I believe it is now time for us to reclaim our right to a full night of sleep. And without embarrassment, or that unfortunate stigma of laziness. And in doing so, we can be reunited with the most powerful elixir of life, the Swiss Army knife of health, as it were. And with that soapbox rant over, I will simply say good night, good luck, and above all, I do hope you sleep well. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Pretty good talk, huh? Yeah, so Jeanette and I'm going to nerd it out a little bit here and read you my notes real quick. Okay.
My dad will be 95 in a couple of months. He takes 2 naps a day, and he's still going strong, and he will absolutely make his naps no matter where we are. We only live in Colorado, but when I visit, I'm going for the nap.
You're welcome. So you might want to see that one again, but I'll just really quickly go through it, and then I have another one to show you that is not quite as good as this, but pretty much. But it adds a fundamental piece to this argument.
Okay, so he said, to summarize too much, too briefly, but he said sleep is necessary for learning, that when you don't sleep enough, he kept kids up all night, and then he looked at activity in the hippocampus, which is the place that takes in new information and makes it into memory and keeps it there. He said that hippocampal activity, when he looked at it, he looked at these kids, they had no activity in the hippocampus. The hippocampus was shut down, so it was impossible to bring new stuff in, or to get new stuff out, or to get old stuff out. That's amazing. The hippocampus didn't work at all. That's it. These are pretty big results. Okay? These are not like 0.05 results. These are like 0.001 results. Okay? These are powerful results. Secondly, he said sleep spindles, which is something I didn't know until I heard him. Sleep, in the neuroscience of yesterday, sleep spindles were something that happened very briefly when you were going to sleep, in stage 2 sleep that you passed through very quickly. But he's saying that they happen in deep sleep, and they help you shift information from short-term to long-term memory. So that if you get enough, if you study something or you read something before you go to sleep, and then you get good sleep, the next morning you know it better. And a lot of people have understood that. But the mechanism is by these sleep spindles. Okay. Then he talked about something that he's working on in his laboratory, direct current brain stimulation. He said that if you give young people a very subtle stimulation in certain areas of the brain, which he didn't mention, in young people, it doubles the amount of memory that you, it doubles your capacity to store things. Which, when the word gets out about this, I don't know how he's going to do this deep brain stimulation thing. You have to drill a little hole in the head, I think, and put electrodes in it. Maybe you can do it. I don't know how you particularize an area.
Yeah, you're right.
Deep brain stimulation, the way it's done now for depression, they have to drill holes into your skull and put electrodes in. Yeah. But when the kids get word of this, and he's a Berkeley professor, people are going to be walking around with holes in their head, you know, because it doubles the amount that you can learn. That's what he's saying. Carl?
Yeah, they're using a little direct stimulation from the outside, electrode one on each side of the head.
Yeah.
Pass a little current through your head.
That's what I anticipated. I put holes in kids' heads, you know.
Yeah.
But the point is, and he could sell these headsets.
Yeah.
You know, and oh my God. Tell me about it. Okay. So, Leon.
I actually have a device. It's about the size of an iPhone. You don't need to go. Dr. Bob Dennis from the University of North Carolina developed this. He originally made the pulse machine. The PMF machine is about that big. But the little ISIS, ICDS, is about that big, and I use it every day, specifically on my hands. And they're very important. I mean, under 1,000.
So what's the name of that?
Well, the one I have is ICDS. I'll forward it to you.
Okay, and then I'll forward it to other people, or you can just ask him. But, yeah, forward it to me.
He doesn't even make money on it. He just wants to get as many money as possible.
So that would also, actually, as magnetic stimulation of various areas of the brain is happening, there might be some ability to do it with magnetic field also. Okay, then he, and so the question is, can we use this technology to keep people from becoming demented and maybe even developing Alzheimer's? Then he talked about the experiment that was done with, that we get done on us twice a year where we lose an hour or we gain an hour of sleep. And he said that sleep seems to be implicated in both heart disease, or lack of sleep in heart attacks, and lowering the reproductive system's ability. And then he talked about the immune system and natural killer cells, which clean up precancerous cells routinely as they're made in your body. Your body has to replace its cells all the time. And so it's constantly making new cells, some of which are not very, they're not good, and if they got into organs in your body, they would cause tumors, and natural killer cells just, they're like a quality control, they get rid of them. But if you don't have natural killer cells, you don't get rid of those precancerous cells. And he said with 4 hours sleep a night, for just one night, that there was a 70% drop in natural killer cell activity. I'm not sure if it was the amount, number of natural killer cells or their activity, but a 70% drop. That's pretty radical. Then he said sleep deprivation is implicated in, because of that, because of the natural killer cells being depressed, or the natural killer cell activity being depressed, or not making enough natural killer cells, sleep deprivation is implicated in bowel, prostate, and breast cancer. And I think he even said that shift work is now being talked about as a carcinogen, right? And then he, a quote from him, the shorter your sleep, the shorter your life. And then they did an experiment where some people got 6 hours of sleep a night for 1 week versus the normal 8 hours. And they looked, so one group got 6 hours of sleep for a night for a week, and the other group got 8 hours of sleep per night for a week. And then they found that there was a difference in 700 and some genes in terms of their activity. About half of them were upregulated and half of them were downregulated. And the ones that were downregulated, that is, less active, were the ones that helped your immune system, that worked your immune system. And the ones that were upregulated did things like created chronic inflammation, tumors, and a stress response, which leads to cardiovascular disease. So then this is the last thing. Then he said two things about better sleep, besides not doing alcohol and caffeine and not relying on sleep medications, is regularity is king. And that's a quote from him, and then keep it cool. 65 degrees or so, he said, is optimal. And then the last quote from him, sleep is a non-negotiable biological necessity. any comment before I show you the second video? Leon, and then Gordon. Yeah.
I've been studying sleep for decades, and I get 9 hours a night. One of the people I study, there was research done studying diaries of people pre-electric light, like in the 1880s and 90s, and they examined tens of thousands of personal diaries, and the average person pre-electric light was actually sleeping 10 hours a night. So 8 hours was, you know...
It's an artificial concept.
Exactly. And so six is really in the scary zone. In the longer, you know, it's like the 100-year weather, you know, because they already have the temperature over 100 years. So eight is really kind of a more modern number.
Let me respond to that and we'll go on. Bill Dement, the great sleep researcher at Stanford, said that the worst thing ever to happen to human health is the electric light. Because you know how sleep works. Like in nature, light goes down, the pineal gland registers that and secretes melatonin, and you go to sleep, and then light comes up, and then the pineal gland stops secreting melatonin, and you wake up. That's the way that you're programmed, you know, by your biology. But the minute that light goes down, you turn this on, and in the middle of the night, you're watching your screen, and you know how that works. And when the light comes up, you just have blackout shades. And so we've totally confused that system, which is why people have to take melatonin, because the brain has gotten confused about when to make it. Let's see. Gordon was next, then Robert, then Robert. Gordon.
Yes. I go to bed every night about the same time, and so-called sleep for 8 or 9 hours, but I don't sleep because I can't fall asleep. I mean, for maybe an hour or two, and then I fall asleep for a couple hours, and I wake up, and I can't get back to sleep for another hour. So I end up just sleeping maybe 5 or 6 hours a night total, even though I'm resting for 8 or 9 hours. Is there anything to be said about that, just to be resting, or do you actually have to sleep for 8 hours?
I don't know the answer to that because I'm not a sleep researcher. My guess is the following. My guess is, and many of us have the same experience.
Right.
My guess is that very good rest is somewhat restorative, but not as restorative as deep sleep. So better than not resting, but probably not as good as resting. However, if you can sleep, your deep sleep tends to happen earlier in the night. More of it happens earlier. And your lighter sleep and more REM sleep, that is the dreaming sleep, happens later. So if you can go to sleep and sleep for 3 or 4 hours, you're getting a substantial amount of your deep sleep because it's weighted toward the beginning of the night. So that's an encouraging thought. Robert is next, then Robert, and then Carl.
I don't have anything definitive to say, but I've seen different historical accounts of sleep patterns, and one of them is that people do, in fact, take naps right after lunchtime, and in civilized countries, that's still true. Like, if you go to Italy or France, in much of the country, they have a break after lunch. And the other thing that you find historically is there's a lot of records of people having so-called two sleeps, of having an early night sleep and then a later night sleep and being up in the middle. So I was a little bit concerned when he said don't nap, because my understanding is there was a particular experiment where people were put in a cave for a month in a real research experiment, and they watched their sleep cycle with no cues at all. And what it was is they had a pattern that was similar to sleeping about 7 hours at night and then an hour or two in the afternoon. And one other thing, that advanced an hour a day. Anyway.
Yeah, unfortunately, when they put people in the cave, they went to sleep an hour later and they didn't have any time indication because it was a dark, you know, they couldn't see the sunlight, they were down in the cave. They went to sleep an hour later every night. It clocked that way. Okay, so I'm not a sleep researcher, I don't know, but this is important, obviously. So Robert, and then Carl, and then we're going to see the next one.
Yeah, it's kind of related to some of the other comments about sleeping during the day, because there were, in history, people like Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla were famous for not sleeping. And then maybe they were getting some of that back by catnapping during the day. But I don't know if that's just dismissed as being anecdotal, or that people have different biological patterns there.
I think certainly that's something you didn't say. We're not all the same. I think that there's an optimal level for each of us, and that level is going to vary from person to person. And there are people on record that sleep 15 minutes or half an hour a night is all in a function. So yeah, I'm sure that there's individual differences here. Okay, so Carl, loud.
One aspect of the research I found interesting was there's typical cycles of about 90 minutes, and that from the shallow sleep to the deepest sleep is restoring memories and memory capacity. So that if you sleep, you may wake up various times during the night, but if you sleep 90-minute cycles, then you can still get fully restorative sleep. If you go through several of these cycles in a night, so maybe 4 cycles, typical, you know, that's not saying everybody, but that's sort of the average. So you could be waking up or getting up easily, you could right back to sleep and have another 90 minutes, and there's this completeness at the 90-minute scale.
Let me put that on the board, that little diagram, so you can see it. Real quick, I didn't know where we were going here, but there we go. Okay, so
This is hours of sleep. This is depth of sleep. Might as well show you your brain wave at each point. This is awake. And your brain wave looks like this. If we put an EEG on your head and we look at the electricity on your skull, which reflects what's happening in your brain works electrochemically. A little bit of that electricity you can register on the skull. You can see that it's kind of moving from place to place on the skull. And you can amplify it a lot of times and you can see a brain wave. So right now your basic brain wave is called beta, and it's about 13 to 18 cycles a second. That is, there's a pulse of electricity going across your skull about 13 to 18 times a second. Like that. Okay, it's fast. So that's a beta rhythm. I'll put that there. And so as you start to go to sleep, this depth of sleep, you go into stage one. And in stage one sleep, you still have this basic beta pattern, but every once in a while you get something like this. And that's alpha. That shows you your eyes are closed and you're relaxing. So when you were meditating, you were having alpha activity. Not entirely, but every once in a while there were some alpha waves, which are bigger and slower than the beta waves. I'm exaggerating here, but just to give you a feeling for that. That's stage one sleep. You don't stay in it very long. You go down after a few more minutes if you're sleeping normally into stage two. And in stage two, you get sleep spindles occasionally, and you get something called K processes. So it's kind of a sloppy, so some of this, but it's kind of some other stuff coming in. You go through it really quickly. And then you go down into stage three and stage four. So in stage three and stage four, should be even make it a little steeper. Like that. In stage three and stage four, what's happening is your brain is slowing down. Your brain activity is slowing down. Again, I'm exaggerating, but you're starting to get in stage three, you're starting to get something like this. And in stage four, you get something really nice like this. And this is called delta waves. This is 1 to 4 cycles per second. So you've gone from 13 to 18 cycles per second to 1 to 4 cycles. So your brain is going wrong, wrong. So it's like you're getting turned down. By the way, this was found in 1952 by a guy named Eugene Azarinsky, who hooked up his 8-year-old son, Armand Azarinsky, to an EEG that he thought was broken. And Armand went to sleep with the EEG hooked up, and he found this pattern. And he realized that either I've got a very screwy EEG machine, or I've just found something important, and it turned out that he had found something earth-shakingly important. And Armand Azarinsky, the guy who was hooked up at 8 years old, is now a famous psychologist. Anyway, back to this. So what happened to Armand Azarinsky in 1952, and what happens to you every night of your life, pretty much, this is, your brain wants to preserve this pattern, is after about 90 minutes, as Carl said, a golden time. You know why movies used to be 90 minutes long?
90.
Because attention wanes after about 90 minutes. You can keep attentive to something for about 90 minutes, then you lose the ability to be attentive. That's why if a movie was going to be long like Lawrence of Arabia, they had an intermission at 90 minutes. That also because you would then go buy popcorn and, you know. Anyway.
Bring that back.
So what happens after 90 minutes? Now, what everybody expected is you're going to stay in deep sleep for a long time, and then you're going to slowly come out of sleep. That's the way it works, right? Your brain goes quiet and it stays quiet, and then 4, 5, or 6 hours it starts to innervate. So everybody thought it was going to go like this. But it didn't. Your brain goes on a roller coaster every night, and what happens is at 90 minutes, it abruptly comes up like this, and for maybe 15 minutes, this is approximate, you're in a state where if we look at your brain wave, now it's called, it goes like this. It looks like you're awake. Looks almost like this. We call, and if we, during this 15-minute period, not only is your brain like you were awake, but your heartbeat goes up, your respiration rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. Your body physiologically looks like it's awake, except for two things. First, your eyes are closed, and if we could watch your eyes, what would happen? Every once in a while, not continuously, but every once in a while in this period, your eyes would be going back and forth like this, like you were watching something. So that's called rapid eye movement sleep, REM sleep. And one more thing. Three more things. One more thing is, if we woke you up here, you would say, whether or not you think you dream, whether or not you remember that you dream, you would go, oh my God, I was having this amazing dream. Almost always, when we wake people up in REM sleep, they report a vivid dream. Rarely, but occasionally, when you wake them up in deeper stages of sleep, they report a dream. So it's not that you can't dream in deep sleep. It's much rarer than the invariant or almost invariant dreaming here. Two more things about this. One is, even though your physiology looks like you're awake, you're paralyzed. Your big muscles don't move. Why would nature do that? Come on, smart people. Why would nature do that?
So you don't kick your wife.
So you don't punch somebody or jump out a window or do any of the stupid things you do when you're sleeping, when you're dreaming. Okay? So you don't act out your dreams. Except for, but there is one other thing I didn't tell you, which is that even in young children, there is genital arousal during REM sleep. There's something exciting for the body about REM sleep. It doesn't mean you're dreaming about sex. It means genital arousal is part of REM sleep. So then you stay in here for maybe 15 minutes, go abruptly down into deep sleep again, and about at 3 hours, 90 minutes, okay, this is not the scale, you might have 20 minutes of REM. Then you go down into deep sleep again, but not quite as deep. You go to stage 3, and about 4.5 hours, you come up for maybe 25 minutes, approximately, of REM sleep. And then you go back down, and about, let's go to 3 again, and then 2, yeah, it's going to be right. Okay, and then about 6 hours, you come up for maybe 30 minutes. I might be off a little bit here, I might have to recalculate. Anyway, and then you go, after 30 minutes of REM sleep, you go back down, but this time only to stage 2. And then at about 7.5 hours, you come up for maybe another 30 minutes, and then you wake up. So how many minutes are you in REM sleep? 60, 85, 105, 120? 90 to 120 minutes of REM sleep a night in 4 or 5 cycles like this. So you are dreaming 4 or 5 times a night for almost 2 hours, which we generally aren't aware of. But this is a movie that you are writing, producing, directing, and starring in, and it is relevant to the deep concerns of your life. Would it not be appropriate to kind of watch that movie occasionally and learn from it? And even if you're lucid, L-U-C-I-D, start to do something about what goes on, so you don't run away from the monsters anymore, you conquer them, and then you become less fearful in your daily life? Maybe. So here are 2 tips, and then we got to go back to this. 2 tips for how to become more dream aware. It's a whole other lecture, but how to become more dream aware. Tip 1, when you go to sleep, say to yourself, when I wake up tomorrow morning, I want to, the first thing, before anything else, I want to capture a little bit of a dream. Okay? Whatever, an image or two of a dream.
I just want to say that on my Spencer website, I gave 2 talks here on this, and if you go there, they're both there.
Ah, go to Rob, because he's going to do a much better job than I'm doing now. Go to swt.org/Spencer and go to what
it says Lucid Dreaming Talks by Robert.
Lucid Dreaming Talks by Robert, okay? Yeah. So definitely go there. So one thing you can do is you can, when you first get up in the morning, you can give yourself a suggestion right before you go to sleep. You can bring back a little dream content. And then dream content just is what's in your unconscious mind. It's what's going on, you know, on a non-conscious level. You can reconstruct. You can pull out more of that content just by being creative. You can say, what would happen next? What would happen next? You can write a story. You can paint a painting. What would happen next? What would happen next? You can do a dance. You can do a song. Anything that would be creative would pull that same material up. The other thing you can do is you can set up, you can, if you're sleeping with somebody, you can have them, if they really love you, they can watch your eyes, they can wait until you start dreaming, and they can watch your eyes, and then they can wake you up in the middle of a dream, or you can set an alarm for 90 minutes, or you can set an alarm for 15 minutes earlier than you generally get up, and you will probably interrupt your last REM period. One more thing about this is, let's say you get up. Oh, some people dream a lot, and they think, oh, I'm really brilliant because I dream a lot, and other people don't remember their dreams very much. Maybe people who dream a lot just get up a lot in the middle of the night during REM periods, and they're just actually sleeping worse. And people that don't dream much, they're just actually getting more deep. They're not waking up in the middle of REM periods. Their sleep isn't so disturbed or intermittent. In any event, if you get up in the middle of a REM period, and you go, oh my God, I was just having a dream of blah, 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 that's a wonderful dream, or a terrible dream, and then you go to the bathroom, and then you come back and you say, what was that dream? Two possible reasons why you don't remember what you were just dreaming. Reason one is the Freudian reason, it gets re-repressed because it's too hot to handle for your conscious mind. Now we generally think that the reason that you don't remember your dreams is because the areas of your brain that have to do with memory get deactivated during the REM periods. In any event, if you remember something, immediately, before you do anything else, write it down or speak it into your phone. That way, you'll be able to deal with it in the morning. You'll be able to puzzle about it in the morning. I can say a little more. I can say a hell of a lot more about this, but I'm not going to because I want to show you another video, okay? So here we go. To get a good night's sleep, and this is a pretty profound reason, okay? So here we go. It's just 11 minutes.
Sleep, it's something we spend about a third of our lives doing. But do any of us really understand what it's all about? 2,000 years ago, Galen, one of the most prominent medical researchers of the ancient world, proposed that while we're awake, our brain's motive force, its juice, would flow out to all the other parts of the body, animating them, but leaving the brain all dried up. And he thought that when we sleep, all this moisture that filled the rest of the body would come rushing back, rehydrating the brain and refreshing the mind. Now, that sounds completely ridiculous to us now. But Galen was simply trying to explain something about sleep that we all deal with every day. See, we all know, based on our own experience, that when you sleep, it clears your mind. And when you don't sleep, it leaves your mind murky. But while we know a great deal more about sleep now than when Galen was around, We still haven't understood why it is that sleep, of all of our activities, has this incredible restorative function for the mind. So today, I want to tell you about some recent research that may shed new light on this question. We found that sleep may actually be a kind of elegant design solution to some of the brain's most basic needs, a unique way that the brain meets the high demands and the narrow margins that set it apart from all the other organs of the body. So almost all the biology that we observe can be thought of as a series of problems and their corresponding solutions. And the first problem that every organ must solve is a continuous supply of nutrients to fuel all of the cells of the body. In the brain, that is especially critical. Its intense electrical activity uses up a quarter of the body's entire energy supply, even though the brain accounts for only about 2% of the body's mass. So the circulatory system solves the nutrient delivery problem by sending blood vessels to supply nutrients and oxygen to every corner of our body. You can actually see it in this video here. Here we're imaging blood vessels in the brain of a living mouse. The blood vessels form a complex network that fills the entire brain volume. They start at the surface of the brain, and then they dive down into the tissue itself. And as they spread out, they supply nutrients and oxygen to each and every cell in the brain. Now, just as every cell requires nutrients to fuel it, every cell also produces waste as a byproduct. And the clearance of that waste is a second basic problem that each organ has to solve. This diagram shows the body's lymphatic system, which has evolved to meet this need. It's a second parallel network of vessels that extends throughout the body. It takes up proteins and other waste from the spaces between the cells. It collects them and then dumps them into the blood so they can be disposed of. But if you look really closely at this diagram, you'll see something that doesn't make a lot of sense. So if we were to zoom into this guy's head, one of the things that you would see there is that there are no lymphatic vessels in the brain. But that doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? I mean, the brain is this intensely active organ that produces a correspondingly large amount of waste that must be efficiently cleared. And yet, it lacks lymphatic vessels, which means that the approach that the rest of the body takes to clearing away its waste won't work in the brain. So how then does the brain solve its waste clearance problem? Well, that seemingly mundane question is where our group first jumped into the story. And what we found as we dove down into the brain, down among the neurons and the blood vessels, was that the brain's solution to the problem of waste clearance, it was really unexpected. It was ingenious, but it was also beautiful. Let me tell you about what we found. So the brain has this large pool of clean, clear fluid called cerebrospinal fluid. We call it the CSF. The CSF fills the space that surrounds the brain, and waste from inside the brain makes their way out to the CSF, which gets dumped along with the waste into the blood. So in that way, it sounds a lot like the lymphatic system, doesn't it? But what's interesting is that the fluid and the waste from inside the brain, they don't just percolate their way randomly out to these pools of CSF. Instead, there is a specialized network of plumbing that organizes and facilitates this process. You can see that in these videos. Here, we're again imaging into the brain of living mice. The frame on your left shows what's happening at the brain's surface, and the frame on your right shows what's happening down below the surface of the brain within the tissue itself. We've labeled the blood vessels in red, and the CSF that's surrounding the brain will be in green. Now, what was surprising to us was that the fluid on the outside of the brain, it didn't stay on the outside. Instead, the CSF was pumped back into and through the brain along the outsides of the blood vessels. And as it flushed down into the brain along the outsides of these vessels, it was actually helping to clear away, to clean the waste from the spaces between the brain cells. If you think about it, using the outsides of these blood vessels like this is a really clever design solution. Because the brain is enclosed in a rigid skull, and it's packed full of cells. So there is no extra space inside it for a whole second set of vessels like the lymphatic system. Yet the blood vessels, they extend from the surface of the brain down to reach every single cell in the brain, which means the fluid that's traveling along the outsides of these vessels can gain easy access to the entire brain's volume. So it's actually this really clever way to repurpose one set of vessels, the blood vessels, to take over and replace the function of a second set of vessels, the lymphatic vessels, to make it so you don't need them. And what's amazing is that no other organ takes quite this approach to clearing away the waste from between its cells. This is a solution that is entirely unique to the brain. But our most surprising finding was that all of this, everything I just told you about, with all this fluid rushing through the brain, it's only happening in the sleeping brain. Here, the video on the left shows how much of the CSF is moving through the brain of a living mouse while it's awake. It's almost nothing. Yet in the same animal, if we wait just a little while until it's gone to sleep, what we see is that the CSF is rushing through the brain. And we discovered that at the same time when the brain goes to sleep, the brain cells themselves seem to shrink, opening up spaces in between them, allowing fluid to rush through and allowing waste to be cleared out. So it seems that Galen may actually have been sort of on the right track when he wrote about fluid rushing through the brain when sleep came on. Our own research, now it's 2,000 years later, suggests that what's happening is that when the brain is awake and is at its most busy, it puts off clearing away the waste from the spaces between its cells until later. And then when it goes to sleep and doesn't have to be as busy, it shifts into a kind of cleaning mode to clear away the waste from the spaces between its brain, the waste that's accumulated throughout the day. So it's actually a little bit like how you or I, we put off our household chores during the work week when we don't have time to get to it. And then we play catch up on all the cleaning that we have to do when the weekend rolls around. Now, I've just talked a lot about waste clearance, but I haven't been very specific about the kinds of waste that the brain needs to be clearing during sleep in order to stay healthy. The waste product of these recent studies focus most on is amyloid beta, which is a protein that's made in the brain all the time. My brain's making amyloid beta right now, and so is yours. But in patients with Alzheimer's disease, amyloid beta builds up and aggregates in the spaces between the brain cells instead of being cleared away like it's supposed to be. And it's this buildup of amyloid beta that's thought to be one of the key steps in the development of that terrible disease. So we measured how fast amyloid beta is cleared from the brain when it's awake versus when it's asleep. And we found that indeed, the clearance of amyloid beta is much more rapid from the sleeping brain. So if sleep, then, is part of the brain's solution to the problem of waste clearance, then this may dramatically change how we think about the relationship between sleep, amyloid beta, and Alzheimer's disease. A series of recent clinical studies suggest that among patients who haven't yet developed Alzheimer's disease, worsening sleep quality and sleep duration are associated with a greater amount of amyloid beta building up in the brain. And while it's important to point out that these studies don't prove that lack of sleep or poor sleep cause Alzheimer's disease, they do suggest that the failure of the brain to keep its house clean by clearing away waste like amyloid beta may contribute to the development of conditions like Alzheimer's. So what this new research tells us then is that the one thing that all of you already knew about sleep, that even Galen understood about sleep, that it refreshes and clears the mind, may actually be a big part of what sleep is all about. See, you and I, we go to sleep every single night, but our brains, they never rest. While our body is still, and our mind is off walking in dreams somewhere, the elegant machinery of the brain is quietly hard at work, cleaning and maintaining this unimaginably complex machine. Like our housework, it's a dirty and a thankless job, but it's also important. In your house, if you stop cleaning your kitchen for a month, your home will become completely unlivable very quickly. But in the brain, the consequences of falling behind may be much greater than the embarrassment of dirty countertops. Because when it comes to cleaning the brain, it is the very health and function of the mind and the body that's at stake. Which is why understanding these very basic housekeeping functions of the brain today may be critical for preventing and treating diseases of the mind tomorrow. Thank you.
I just forgot his name. It's a TED Talk, yeah. It's.
Alright, so what he said in a nutshell is
Jeff,
brain produces waste, there's no lymph to get rid of it. So how does the brain get rid of its waste? It pumps right. cerebrospinal fluid into the brain, and then pumps it back out, and then that gets dumped into the blood. But it only can pump the cerebrospinal fluid in when you're sleeping, because then the brain cells shrink and there's space created between the cells where the cerebrospinal fluid can go in. One of the kinds of waste that the brain makes routinely is amyloid beta. And if you don't sleep enough, then it doesn't get flushed out the way that it should, or taken out by the cerebrospinal fluid, and that may be a contributor to or cause of things like Alzheimer's disease. So those are sobering ideas. We kind of need to break now, but I gotta say two things. One thing is I don't know, again, what's going to happen for next week's class and April 3rd's class. I have a hunch they're going to cancel them, but if they don't, you'll hear. Pay attention to what you hear about City College. Email me if you need to know. I will email you as soon as I know. If there is class next week, we'll have it. And if there is class on April 3rd, we'll have it. But if we don't have it, I just want to appreciate you. I want to say how grateful I am that we're a community and that we investigate the things we investigate and that we do the things we do. And I'll be really sad if we don't do the art show, but there'll be, you know, we'll do something like this in the fall. I'm not sure the format yet for the fall, whether it'll be 10 weeks or 5 weeks. We're still kind of figuring that out, but we'll do this again in the fall, and we'll certainly have our art show then if we don't have it on April 3rd.
We'll be in the summertime.
We don't meet in the summertime. If one more thing. If we do meet in the fall and it turns out to be a paid class, it might be that way just because of the vagaries of administration. If that's the case, then if anybody wants a scholarship, pay attention. Those scholarships are available, but you apply for them, I think, early in the summer. So if you would like a scholarship for a paid class, it wouldn't be much, but you know, the class won't cost much, but if it's a paid class and you want a scholarship, don't hesitate to apply. They're for you. So stay well. Be well and stay well. And I will see you either next week or in the fall.